Yes, I want to talk about well, some insights that I think we can get on where gravity comes from, thinking about things in string theory as well as things from black hole physics, and try to sort of find a common denominator in these things that we've learned. So this is sort of an outline. I will first start actually from a string perspective a little bit to explain also part of the intuition. It's related to sort of open-closed dualities and UVIR correspondences, which are deeply ingrained in string theory, which I think also contains a more general lesson, well, which may even be not just applying to string theory. Then I'll go to the proposal of thinking about gravity as an entropic force. But then I'll make that a little more precise by and more refined by also thinking about what's called the Born-Oppenheimer approximation and reaction forces, which is a little bit of a more general perspective on the same phenomenon. Of course, you know Joe's famous calculation, and actually already here, the force between two debris actually shows some emergence of gravity, because there are two ways in which you can think about the force between two debris, either from an open string or from a closed string perspective. If you think about the open string perspective, you're basically summing over all of the modes in between two debris, and you can write this down in some swinger parameterization. And then, of course, the swinger parameter has something to do with the time that sort of goes around the proper time that goes around the open string diagram. If we do a modular transformation, what did I do here?
Integral representation of Yossi.
Sorry?
You did an integral representation of Yossi.
This is just, yeah, of course, by the way, if you sum this up, you will actually see what you're summing up is the 0 point energies of all of the states that are in here, and that they generate the force. But I wanted to do a modular transformation, of course. When I go from S to S2, which is sort of the variable, which is the one that would measure the length between the two, well, in this direction. So what I'm doing here actually is doing an expansion, because I want to figure out what is the pole describing the graviton in that direction. And you can see this by doing expansion and then there's only one term that contributes. Because if I just expand this out, then you find that a lot of the terms actually cancel. Actually, I should have said this. Because basically it's a sum of, if I write it like this, the term in the exponent, you can write this indeed as a 0 point energy, and it's the square root of this mode. This is basically the mass of an open string. This is readable for people. And then there's 1 minus 1 to the f, and you simply sum over all of the modes. Can we get light here or no? Yes, there it is. What makes the graviton contribution work in this channel is that there's cancellations happening in here up to the right order, so that the right pole will come out, which is the pole you normally get associated with the graviton. Now, there's one way to do it, is namely indeed represent this this Gaussian in terms by a Fourier integral, and then of course you have replaced S by one, minus 1 over S, and actually this you can easily recognize will produce, when you integrate over S till the graviton pole. But in order to get this expansion, there are certain sum rules you can even write down, which tell you what the strength is of the gravitational force. It's some sum over the masses that appear in the open string channel. And there's some magical identity that tells you that this object should be equal to the product of the tensions of those two grains. I don't know why that works, but it appears to work in string theory. But this is an emergence of gravity, because you then think about this, of course, in the open string channel.
Eric, this looks like gravity emerging from Casimir energy.
That's correct.
Why is it for bank? I mean, is there a more general definition of passenger energy and entropy? Or
wait till the end of the talk. Because this is, of course, not casting their energy in the space-time itself. So there's actually here even an intermediate picture where you can decide to integrate out part of the open strings and part of the closed strings. Actually, I think there's an important point in string theory is that we have various formulations of string theory depending on what we choose as the interpretation of an open string diagram or a closed string diagram. This diagram can be interpreted either as open or closed string, and there's some point between these two where you have to decide whether I call this an open string one loop amplitude or a closed string propagator. And that parameter is the one that describes the UV-IR correspondence, because they both describe actually UV cutoffs on both the open string as well as the closed string, and they're inversely related. If I go to the UV in the open string channel, I go to sort of an IR in the closed string channel. And so the idea of thinking about gravity as a merchant is that we want to describe everything in the open string channel, so we want to push as far as we can into the UV of the open strings. So this is open strings with the UV cutoff, and then this part would be sort of the rest of it, if you can namely split the two. And then if I do the modular transformation here, you'll find that the closed string channel also has a UV cutoff, but precisely with the inverse of the cutoff that I've put right there. Of course, we also know a matrix description of gravity, and this is something that can emerge when you think about the deep brains going very close to each other and where you only can focus on the lightest nodes of the open string. And this is just a sketchy derivation of it. Because, well, just to give the idea, the matrix looks sort of like this. And if we have a stack of D-brains together here, a big number of them, and one probe brain that we take out, then we take one of the eigenvalues out, and then we have some off diagonal modes. But in order to describe what's happening to the single eigenvalue here, we basically integrate out these off diagonal modes. And it's the fact that their frequency, I mean, basically the harmonic oscillators, that their frequency depends on the distance between the eigenvalues is what gives you a force, even though the potential is flat. Well, if you would do this in a bosonic language, you would find a linear potential. But again, you need to add fermions to get the correct force. And basically, it's the same cancellation that happens here in order to get the correct identity. But what's quite important to do this calculation is that the motion that you consider for this variable is very slow, because then you can use the Born-Oppenheimer approximation for those other variables. So there are fast variables in the problem and there are slow variables in the problem, and the slow variables describe the positions of the D-brain. The fast variables are the modes, sort of, which are the off-diagonal ones that we have to integrate out, and they induce the geometry. So this is a way we understand sort of emergence of gravity in a string language. Now let's go to, well, of course, ADS-CFT, we also know emergence of gravity, and then there's one direction which is sort of special, which in a certain way is a special limit of the matrix theory story, namely what you do with D-brains. To get to ADS-CFT, you take a near horizon limit, it means you really go very close to D-brains, and you take the energy down, and then of course there's one special direction that plays a role. Because if you think about the emergence in this picture, there's no special direction in space that really tells you which direction space is emerging. The emergence of space comes because there are off-diagonal modes that you have to forget about, and you have to control, sort of look at the eigenvalues on the diagonal, which become the positions. But in ADS-CFT, it's a different story. But what I start to realize recently is that ADS-CFT is really sort of a singular limit of a more general story. You really are looking in one particular low energy limit where you put all these things together, and there it appears there's only one holographic direction, sort of the emergent direction. But the general story is, I think, more contained in the matrix calculations. And before ADS-CFT, there were funny, very important calculations leading up to this matrix theory, but also, I mean, there's a paper by which I like a lot, is by Douglas, Kabat, Pulio, and Schenker, who really showed this sort of emergence of a gravitational force from a matrix perspective. And I think that paper should have been probably done more with than we have been doing the last 10 years or so. All right, so if we then think about another point of view, namely black holes, so that's the other thing I want to put in. Of course, we know that in ADS-CFT, we can put black holes in the bulk. And then there's a dual description on the boundary. And we know that when we lower something into the black hole, that this corresponds on the boundary as sort of a thermalization of an object, where this distance away from the black hole is corresponding to the size of the object. So if I pull it out, this thing will become smaller. And you actually pull it out of equilibrium. Because this part, the thing that's describing the object near the black hole, is some operator on the boundary, maybe some Wilson line of a certain size. And the further you go out, the more it's out of equilibrium, the further you go in, it becomes sort of in equilibrium with the thermal heat path. That's thermalization. But now let's ask, what is the cause of the force that's pulling it into the black hole from the boundary perspective? On the boundary, this whole direction isn't there. So why does it want to be in the black hole? Now, the reason is that it, of course, wants to be thermalized, which is a sort of entropic effect. Yes?
We know in global ADS without a black hole that there is such a force on all the objects because there's this conformal coupling of the metric to the scalar, and that gives you a force that forces the eigenvalues to be near zero. So there's no requirement to have entropy there. The force is just there.
You're not disputing what I'm saying here.
I'm disputing that it's just
entropy. No, you're not disputing what I'm saying here. Just then wait for your question. I mean, your question is anticipating things which I haven't said yet. I'm not claiming that in ADS that the force is entropic.
But you have black hole in ADS, so that's fine.
I say that in this situation, where I have a black hole in ADS, the reason that it wants to go into the black hole has an entropic origin.
There's another way of saying it here. I mean, also, an object that's close to the boundary is a very small, you know, localized excitation.
Yes.
And then the process of falling in is just expanding.
That's correct.
Just a statement that, you know, a localized thing disperses in the gauge theory. And that would happen, you know, regardless of whether there's a thermal back at long wavelengths.
Okay, let me then say the additional component to the force due to the black hole, that could be given an entropic interpretation. I mean, you agree with me that thermalization, I mean, if I put in, okay, let me indeed think about before I did this, I thought about another situation. Take two black holes in ADS, but I want to take one circling the other. Because then you would have a fluid on the boundary where if you move the black hole out of the center, you apply a conformal transformation to it, which sort of makes it into a more denser fluid in one case. If you would not have the second black hole, this actually would be possible as well. And then you find that, of course, the black hole starts moving or going in a circle, but this is some kind of motion of the thermal fluid on the boundary. But if I add two of them, of course, the motion will be influenced in a different way, and eventually they will even start to merge, which I think of as some friction between the two fluids, where they indeed thermalize and eventually sort of become one fluid, if you would do that. So I think there already there's interactions between the two things. So clearly here, also in this case, if I take one object out of it, the reason that it wants to go into the black hole has an entropic origin, certainly near the horizon, by the way. I mean, this is where I want to emphasize. So this picture is not for nothing there. I mean, it's very near the horizon that I can make the argument quite precisely. Anyhow, this is an intuition. Let me make it a little more precise by doing a calculation then. So this is a thought experiment, and you can do it in ADS, but you can also do it in empty space, sorry, in flat space, or with a black hole in it. This is, of course, a thought experiment that Bekenstein basically did in the early 70s, I guess, where you lower a particle into a black hole by holding it onto a string or a rope, and you ask what is happening when you drop the particle into the black hole. There's actually a puzzle there, namely if you put the mass on the horizon, there would no energy left anymore. And so in order to make it consistent, what Bekenstein had to argue is that there's some point away from the horizon where you clarify that the particle and the black hole are basically one thing, and that there's a little bit of energy left in the mass of the particle. He took that distance to be one quantum wavelength and then associated one bit with it. But of course, it's somewhat of a little bit of an arbitrary distance to choose. But you cannot put the particle really on the horizon because of some quantum uncertainty. So let me indeed define something like a stretched horizon. And there's no real a priori preferred distance where you have to put that. So whatever I'm going to do is I'm going to say I'm going to take a point away from the horizon where I say everything that's behind it. I give one description, which is basically the black hole. And everything that's outside of it, I can think about still as a particle. But there must be an invariance on how I do this, where I put this, because that's sort of how we now also understand an invariance in ADS as sort of an RG invariance in that direction. So if I think about the force outside where I see what the particle is doing, I can calculate what the force is. You have to think about the displacement. You use the line element. You take the redshifted energy. But you find, of course, that the force is still, the force felt by an observer far away is still just the Newton, it's described by the Newtonian force. This is just a calculation in GR. But if you now think about the situation where you put the particle basically on the inside of the black hole, I could have done the same thing. But since I already say I have no particle at that moment, so the moment when you, for instance, release the particle to make it go into the black hole will increase its mass by a certain amount, but that amount depends on where I drop the particle. If I pull it out a little bit further, it will increase more. That increase is equal to the work that you do when you pull the particle out. But by just consistency of black hole thermodynamics, this would be equal to the change in entropy of the black hole as a result of dropping in the particle times the Hawking temperature of the black hole. And if you work it out, indeed, you find that the temperature, of course, is the acceleration near the horizon, and therefore the difference in the energy, in the entropy, must be some number times m, because the force that you do, you just get it from this equation, must be the product of those two. So I know from this argument what is the increase in the entropy when I put the particle in from a little bit. And these equations are simply true near a black hole horizon. There's no doubt about that. Of course, the question is, how do we interpret them? And how? What is, for instance, the relation then with the matrix picture? So this is where I want to introduce the concept of entropic force, because I want to compare the situation to where we have a polymer. Because I now want to indeed explain that entropy can actually result in a force. It can give you a force. It's called entropic forces, and well, I, you know, let me explain what the polymer, what the happens in the polymer. A polymer, I'm thinking about an idealized situation. So where I think about a polymer as made up out of many monomers, and they can do all kinds of things. They can orient themselves arbitrarily in space, but they're sort of fixed rods with a fixed length, but they can rotate around their points, the connection point. And then you find there are many more configurations when the polymer is short. So the entropy is larger when it's short. But there's no energy difference, because if you would put the polymer out in sort of without a heat bath, it can take any length and any shape with the same energy. But if you put it in a heat bath, it wants to be short, basically, because then it's forced to explore its phase space. And therefore, there's a force. This is the way that rubber works, and then you find that the temperature plays a role in describing the force. You basically look at the partition function of all configurations. So x is the position of this object that you attach to it, and e is the total energy, including that of the heat bath. And you do the total partition sum, where you also introduce an external variable f, which is the thing that keeps this position fixed. It's an external variable, not something that I've introduced in describing the system. I mean, it's really an external thing in the partition function. But you can then determine what f should be to make it in equilibrium by taking the settle point equation. And then you find that just taking the settle point equations there, well, the temperature is given by the usual equation, and the force is determined by the derivative, the partial derivative of the entropy as a function of x. So s is, of course, defined as the logarithm of this omega. Another way of writing this, by the way, is, of course, that f is equal to t. Times the partial derivative of the entropy x. So this is the same equation that I basically had for the force near a black hole horizon. But in this case, the entropy is the cause of the force. You can explain why there is a force on this by calculating the entropy, and then that's generating it. Another way to look at it, by the way, is by looking at it in a microcanonical ensemble. Because I must admit, in even when I know this example because I taught statistical mechanics once in Princeton, but then I had to give this problem to students. But that is a subtle thing, because at first I even was confused about the direction of the force in the case, because what you normally would say, I mean, it's clear that the direction of the force goes in the direction where the entropy would increase. You would expect then that the energy would go bigger if you multiply it with t. So how can the force go in the direction in which the entropy is increasing, and how is that consistent with energy conservation? The point is that the entropy doesn't increase. It's adiabatic. You extract energy from the heat bath. That's precisely when you start lowering this object into the heat bath, you will be extracting energy from it, and you do work on the outside. But in such a way that the whole entropy stays the same. This you can make precise in the microcanonical ensemble, because then you can think about the force as an explicit term that you write down in your ensemble, and you require that the entropy is constant. Then you get the same equations as in the canonical ensemble, but you see it's basically an adiabatic effect. Indeed, for the polymer, the force is given by Hooke's law, and so there's no, it's a fully conservative force, so there's no generation of entropy, nothing is dissipative. And people know this also very well in biological systems. They can look at DNA, for instance, in a thermal situation, and you can do all kinds of things with it, and it's fully reversible. But the ways that it's curling up and getting out again, that's an entropic phenomena as well. But now let me actually answer some of the other questions, which will become clear. But of course, there's another way. I mean, this, of course, one way I can now think about the emergence of gravity near a horizon. We had the other story of string theory, where we integrated out of the diagonal mode. So what is the connection between them? You had a question?
Black hole, this case is definitely requires the heat bath.
Yes.
Just take a polymer. microstate.
Yes.
There is none. You just say it.
Same
energy. So, in principle, in fact, we do it all the time. Take a bunch of sticks, connect them. T is effectively zero for that microscopic collection of sticks, and there is no entropic force. So it does require the ensemble or the interpretation of black hole, something metallic.
In this is usually what we say that entropic force means, but let me refine that indeed, because this, I think, okay, let me say this way, this is the way in which I'd like to interpret gravity in a situation where there is a temperature.
Now I got, so the black hole, this is supposed to look like a black hole.
Yes.
Or which might actually be, I think it was a description of an ensemble of microstates.
Yes.
Now I'd like to ask.
What happens when there's one particular?
To the microstate, which over here, I would interpret as, I know damn well what a microstate of a polymer is, at T equals zero, my ensemble consists of one.
Yes.
And in fact, I can easily construct a mechanical model of that.
Yes.
And you will see there's no force.
Without the heat bath?
Without the heat bath. Right?
I agree.
Or just a bunch of sticks, which I connected
with. No, I agree, there's no force there.
Yeah. So, is that in the case of
but
Matrix model, for example, or AUCFP, I mean, I can pick up the microstates and the bulk description of those will have no such force. Because I know you're now going to move to something which will.
No, but I think it's the same thing. I don't think so, that there's a difference between what I'm going to say next and this situation. There are just various limits, and I'll try to interpolate between them, but you'll see that there's no clear difference between all of those. But maybe I should go for the rest of the audience to the next stage.
So you really, do I understand then that this is not so much, if I'm, this is a limiting case of something which is a more fundamental.
That's correct. And for me, this is.
You stated in the paper, it sort of sounds like
I understand.
This is the fundamental concept.
I think there's still an idea here, and for me, it's more, as I said, in the operative sentence that there are degrees of freedom which are not the slow variables like the position, which are being influenced when I move this object, and which are, in a sense, responsible for the force. And so this object, when it moves, it influences, in this case, the number of possible microstates of the polymer. And in the case of the matrix theory, it influences the off-diagonal modes of the matrix. And it's those degrees of freedom that are relevant for understanding the emergence of gravity. So even with the let me, yeah.
In this case, for example, you have to lower that point in.
Yes. So, but
slow. Time enough for the
thing to. Okay. Oh, yeah. So it's true that this is only true when you do it very slowly, because the adiabatic. This is an adiabatic force, and of course, if you plunge it in or do it too fast, you will generate entropy. And that's also, by the way, where I think eventually there are corrections to this, where it becomes non-conservative and there will be dissipation happening, and so etc. And so we know that near black hole horizons there is dissipative behavior, and those are the corrections to this sort of purely adiabatic way of doing things. And you can calculate, actually, I mean, if I continue, I'll show you, there is actually a formalism that allows you to calculate these corrections.
Eric?
Yes?
So this is supposed to apply for, all black holes. That forces near black holes, asymptotic
horizons, say.
Horizons. So the fact that black holes have negative specific heat, or their entropy grows so much faster with energy than ordinary thermal things, does it play a role here?
I don't see, I mean, this is really more like a probe brain. Kind of calculation that I'm doing here, in the sense that I think for probe, so I really think about this mass as an object near a black hole horizon, where it's just testing, I mean, you use this to test the force. So I don't think we're really disturbing the black hole by that much that we would be able to sort of see the negative specific heat of it. Certainly in the situation that I'm looking at here, indeed I think about this as slow motion, but I also think about the heat path in the limit where it's very large. So I don't think that then the negative specific heat will play a very important role. But maybe we should discuss this because it has probably to do with the fluctuations around it, because when I start differentiating, for instance, variables, then at some moment I will hit the specific heat, which may give me some sense of what fluctuations would be. I haven't thought about that actually, but just the analogy, of course, I mean, I already mentioned the word. This is the single eigenvalue. This could be the collection of D brains together, and this is sort of a graphical picture of the same kind of configuration. But of course, this is thermodynamics, while the other thing had to do with some quantum mechanics, where you integrate out some modes, and as Joe said, maybe even with some Casimir-type way of looking at it. But there's a link between them, which indeed is this Born-Oppenheimer picture. If you think about the heat path as microscopic fast variables, and the particle that's outside as slow variables, then there's an adiabatic way of doing the quantum mechanics where you basically solve the Schrödinger equation for the fast variables where you keep the slow variable fixed. And then if you're in an eigenstate of that Hamiltonian, you'll stay in an eigenstate of that Hamiltonian. Now, what has that to do with an entropic force? Well, at least not directly entropic in the usual sense, but you can use the same reasoning and the same equations even to describe this. Why? There's basically a theorem that says that when the system is ergodic or, well, has certain properties, and indeed the motion is infinitely slow, the eigenvalues don't cross. You basically stay, all of the eigenvalues will become function of the variable x. And we know we're in one of the eigenstates, so it's even a pure state, but we want to know what this eigenstate does as a function of the slow variable. What I need to know to do that is not the solution to the entire Hamiltonian, the Schrödinger equation or the full eigenvalues. No, what I need to know is how many eigenvalues do we have below a certain energy, because that has to stay fixed. So what I'm going to do is just look at the following. I'm looking at a quantity which I call omega e and x, which is just, I do it using semi-classical way of counting states. I integrate the volume of phase space up to a certain energy e. That counts how many eigenvalues I have up to that energy e. In order to know what this eigenvalue is doing, I keep that constant. You put this equation, you write it down, you get the equations. The same equations that define an entropic force. There's not a temperature, there's not a... It's a pure state. The role of the temperature is just played by this quantity. And so the same equation can be interpreted in a different way. Namely, what is this? This is just telling you how many levels you go down. In order to know what the energy cost is, you have to know what is the distance between energy levels. That's the role of the temperature. And of course, this is the way we can think about the matrix case and about adiabatic Born-Oppenheimer forces. And it's the link between the two. This is in a beautiful paper by Barry and Robbins explained, where they even explain the following. This is only in an approximation when the motion is infinitely slow, as I said. You can derive this from quantum mechanics, but also in some more classical form. They do it actually classically, and then they are computing what are the corrections when the motion is not really slow. You find in the classical situation there is dissipation added to it, but also other forces. One of the forces that you get is what they call the reaction forces, is due to the Berry phase. No, it just has to do with, of course, the phase of the wave function, but there's a classical analogy of analog of that is called the Tanai angle. I don't even know the name exactly, but there's in classical mechanics there's some angle variable that also plays a role there. But when eigenvalues cross, even more dramatic things will happen, which I'll describe later on.
Okay, but this looks like the previous thing. If five omega is an entropy and if T is a temperature.
No, what I would like to say, this looks like the previous thing when there, no. What I like to say is that what I call their temperature, I'll call this here, and this is the link between. So what I'm thinking about, there is a description near the horizon, and I want to pull out the object. Eventually, I will not be in the thermal situation anymore. But still, of course, gravity, the equations don't change. If I interpret gravity entropically near the horizon, I want to have an analogous description when I'm not at the horizon, which would not be a thermal situation. So this is the analogous
situation. This is just general.
This is general Born Oppenheimer, but
general Born Oppenheimer, is there some argument that in some situation, in any case, log omega becomes?
So what I think will happen is that you go from a situation where things look more like, I can take this state and count how many there are. I can go lower and lower.
Sorry, how many there are below it?
Below it. Eventually, for the Casimir case, I look at the ground state. It's still adiabatic. But when what I think will happen is that what the calculation was that I did there, when you start going closer and closer to the horizon, the oscillators, think about many oscillators. That has many conserved quantities. But if I have a big phase space and I move around in that phase space, eventually ergodically, you're basically covering the entire energy surface in phase space. And there's no way that from a macroscopic perspective we can distinguish that from a state that really would cover the entire energy surface, which is a microcanonical description of the thermal state. Or as I would say, yeah, a thermal state. Microcanonically, I can think about a state in a certain energy state when the state in time covers the entire energy surface, then time averages will basically be integrals over the total energy surface. And then I have just a microcanonical picture of a state in a certain. And then I can just do a Legendre transform and it looks thermal. There's no difference between an ergodic system time averaged and a thermal system. So it's just time averaging added to this picture that makes it a thermal state. There's actually even a way to do dynamics. Actually, it's in this paper by Barry and Robbins. They say, well, you can even think about the slow variables as being phase space variables, as long as it's slow compared to the other ones. Then you the slow phase space variables are called xi. You integrate out over the fast variables, but you require that the motion is in such a way that you still do it adiabatically, that this entropy quantity that I define here is constant. Of course, it doesn't really matter because it's constant whether I call this a logarithm or even the function itself. Any function then becomes an adiabatic invariant. Back to the gravity situation. So I told you that near horizon I can interpret the force as such an entropic force. So an entropic force to me is where I can then write it in terms of the temperature, what I call a temperature, times the gradient of an entropy. And here I'm again doing just the phenomenology of what I know about, for instance, Wendler horizons. Because if I near a black hole horizon, if I'm very close and the black hole is very big, it doesn't really look anything different than from a Wendler horizon. So I can write down the same equations and they should be true. For whom, by the way? For an observer that's indeed holding a string attached to the mass and tries to sort of see what is the cause of it when I lower it into the black hole horizon, into the horizon. So the horizon is an horizon for this someone that's being accelerated, but also actually for someone that's very far out. But anyhow, in order to get the usual Newton law out of the Undo temperature, you basically can determine what is the change in entropy. So if I lower the particle towards the horizon, I can again put here some stretched horizon, by the way, and then ask what is the change in entropy associated with moving the particle in. Because in the same way, from the observer at who's being accelerated here, if he drops the particle and let it sort of disappear, the knowledge about this particle will disappear and it will turn into entropy. And there's a certain way he can think about that horizon as being also described by some degrees of freedom, and which we can associate an entropy with. The entropy, by the way, is infinite. Of course, the total entropy is infinite because there's an infinite horizon. There's even a little bit of a funny thing about this situation, namely the direction of the force is determined by this, where the entropy is changing, which is in that direction. By the way, you can think about this entropy now in the Born-Oppenheimer way, if you want to think about it that way. But if for a winter horizon, there is actually a real temperature, namely the Unruh temperature. That's really a temperature that's there. It's sort of suggested, by the way, that if you look at this equation, MC, I mean, I've had here the Compton wavelength on the right-hand side of 1 over the Compton wavelength. If you take this out and think about S as the log of a wave function, it sort of looks like the definition of momentum. It suggests even a relation with quantum mechanics. Of course, I already mentioned the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and actually there is actually a reason why you would like this interpreter right inside more like a momentum, because if this would be sort of like a Hamilton-Jacobi function, its derivative with the position x would be the momentum. So then you would like to replace sort of C with a V. Because what is C? C is indeed, plays the role. This formula actually is correct near horizons, whether it's black hole horizons or Windler horizons or even cosmological horizons. But you would like to know, of course, if you go away from the horizon, what is sort of are these formulas becoming? And then you think about C as being sort of the escape velocity from the horizon to the observer that's going out. So there's a certain limit that they've taken when you go to the horizon. And you might expect that there's certain changes of these formulas when you are not at the horizon. And there's a natural V that plays a role here, namely it would be the escape velocity, which if it's not C, you can still think all these equations might be true. There's actually a reason for that. Go ahead.
We're moving very rapidly. That formula was originally, that's the Bekenstein formula, which is the quantum uncertainty which interpreted the wavelength. It wasn't a velocity particular, it was just a conversion of
that's correct.
Mass to momentum.
That's correct. So this is just suggested what I'm saying.
It's getting farther and farther away from the motivation. From where that equation came from.
This equation was motivated near the horizon. If I interpret, or actually you can derive it. If I say what is.
Still the thing above.
No, but for, okay, if I go back to the black hole case. If I'm in this situation, where I say, what is the entropy associated with everything that's behind this stretched horizon? And I calculate what the difference between in that entropy is, whether I drop the particle from here or from there. You can calculate that difference in entropy, and you'll find these formulas. This can be derived. It's not an assumption. And if it's true for a black hole horizon, it's true for any horizon. So I'm just taking this formula, which can be derived, and apply it to the Windler horizon. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, but then replacing C by.
Oh, sorry, that was suggestive. I was just trying to say anticipate something that I'm going to do next.
Yeah.
Let me, and this is actually because I haven't derived, okay, I've derived that equation, but we don't know whether any equation of this sort is true when we're not at horizon. which, of course, I mean, in the paper I tried to do this, but I'm now going doing it more carefully. Because I'm going to take one particular example, which is the sitter space, and there I can play more games. Because let me need say it this way, if I assume this equation to be true everywhere, which it cannot be, by the way, this is true for, what does the equation mean? This is the entropy associated that an observer would associate with the horizon there, and which would change when he would lower the particle towards the screen. He would say that the amount of entropy on the screen that's changing is this amount. But it's a very specific question for a particular observer. Because let us imagine the situation that I take the acceleration slowly to zero. The distance between the horizon and this point is 1 over the acceleration. So this screen will, this horizon will move away. And while this equation stays the same, it doesn't depend on the acceleration. The temperature will go down. At some moment, the horizon is all the way to infinity. And you might think about the situation where I let the acceleration go to the other direction, change sign. Then, since this equation stayed the same, and it determined the direction of the force, it cannot happen, of course. This is also why it's clear that you're actually looking at a situation which is dependent on the observer. This was the entropy that an observer that's far out associated with the horizon. So if I start changing the direction, I have to put the observer from there to the other side, and the horizon will appear on the other side, and for that observer, the gradient goes in the other direction. But this is, of course, sort of a singular situation, but it's funny to do this now in a cosmological situation when there's a cosmological horizon, because then this thing cannot go all the way to infinity. And then you'll see that this equation will indeed change, because I want to keep, of course, Newton's law. So this is what I'm going to do. Oh yeah, there's another thing. I cannot keep this equation, because if I would do this in the sitter space, in the sitter space there is a temperature, because there is a horizon. And you can write this temperature in terms of an acceleration. Well, just in the Undo form, and so the acceleration is defined in the cosmological constant in a certain way. But there's no force. You're sitting in the center of the sitter space. And the reason is, of course, that the horizon is all the way around you. So there's no direction even of the gradient of the entropy that you can find. There's no preferred direction. But I can start doing the same thing. I'm going to now think about an observer sitting in the center who's going to lower, not really lower, but let a particle approach his horizon. The horizon is now here, the cosmological horizon. And then that means that you're actually accelerating the particle. Because a particle that was sitting here would like to accelerate away from the center. If you want to keep it there, you have to apply a force. And you can calculate this force and give it an entropic interpretation in terms of what is the change of the entropy on the horizon. Again, you can calculate what's happening to this entropy by allowing the particle to go slowly towards the horizon. It's just consistency of the thermodynamics in the sitter space. And in this case, there's no question, there's a temperature. It's all an equilibrium, there's only the sitter space with temperature, and I put one test particle in, and I ask what's happening to that particle, then I move it out a bit. Now, it turns out that if you think locally about what the temperature is here, you think about that it's the Undo temperature because it's being accelerated, but the Undo temperature in the sitter space is not just the usual Undo formula, but you have, of course, when there's no acceleration, there was already a temperature, so you have to combine the sitter temperature together with this Undo temperature, and the formula turns out to be this. You have to take the square root of a squared plus a zero squared, and one way to think about it is to think about, indeed, the sitter space as being embedded in one dimension higher, and then already without having an acceleration, it looks like accelerating, and it's just the total acceleration that determines the temperature. This is a paper by Desser and, you know, probably Abbott. I don't know. There's a paper by Stanley Desser and another author, which I forgot, that has this temperature. So this is the temperature. One other way to think about the temperature is the following. This observer has this sit-up temperature. The particle that's sitting here is being redshifted. There's a redshift between the two. And you can basically multiply the temperature with the redshift factor. So the temperature here is higher, because if you multiply it with the redshift factor, you get the correct temperature here. Another way to think about, by the way, the redshift is indeed as a Doppler shift. If I think about the sitter space more as sort of an expanding universe, then there's the Hubble formula for the acceleration away. And so there's a certain Doppler shift that you apply here. So then there is indeed sort of a velocity that plays a role, because I can think about the redshift as a velocity in terms of velocity. Now I want to get the force on this particle, again by similar reasoning. Now the force is just given by Newton's law. Anyhow, by the way, now we see a nice thing happening, is that when I change the acceleration and go to zero, what happens is not that I get a new horizon. The only thing that changes is that the horizon that's already there just stays there. So the Rinker horizon is the cosmological horizon. This accelerated object has the same horizon as the person in the middle. You're basically just moving it a little bit. And so it goes much smoother, and you should expect, and therefore also a smooth way of going from this situation to the other situation. And you can calculate this just by imposing that the force is just given by Newton's law. Because then I can multiply these two and get F equals m mod a.
Wait, I'm not trying to logic. You're assuming Newton's law and deriving this?
But by the same reasoning, just requiring consistency of the thermodynamics of the entire system.
But there's something which is bothering me about the change in entropy. So, when you have some thermodynamic analogies and stuff, but when you talk about black holes, you say this is just black hole mechanics and so on. If you try to do the same thing here, you know, if you're in a limit where the mass is a test particle and not back reacting, of course the horizon doesn't change when the particle goes across it, and there's no change in entropy. And if you include the mass, then even if the mass is inside the horizon, before it's crossed the horizon, the area changes. Right? The cosmological horizon of a Schwarzschild sitter is not the same place,
mm-hmm.
because the mass inside has already shifted
yes.
area.
Yes.
The cosmological horizon doesn't really, you don't have to wait for it to cross the horizon. So.
Yes, but I can still ask the following. So let me indeed include this in the entire object. So it's not exactly the sitter, it's the sitter with a particle.
Okay.
And then I move it out a little bit. Actually, what I need to do is even think about, again, a little bit the stretched horizon case. But then I allow my stretched horizon even to sort of go inside. Now you're actually helping me here with making the argument more precise, because I think the reasoning that I gave for the black hole is that I want to compare two situations. One where the particle is still part in the space inside the horizon, or outside the horizon for a black hole, but here would be inside the horizon. And I want to compare that to the situation when I would put the particle on the other side of what I would call the holographic screen, which would be a stretched horizon right here in the middle. And then I can ask, what is the interpretation of that force in terms of the degrees of freedom that I would put there? Anyhow, there's a change of entropy. I think here, by the way, it should just also the same thing. If I let go of this particle, so I let it go towards the horizon, just keeping it very slowly, and then suddenly I let go of it. It will go past it. And then there will be a difference, there will be an effect on the horizon, even the cosmological horizon, which I can then calculate in terms of what is the entropy associated to that. And then I can compare two situations, where I do it here or at a slightly different location. And because the energy that this particle will have when it sort of goes over the horizon is different in the two situations, just consistency of the sitter thermodynamic rules tell me that this equation should be true. This is the difference in change in the entropy of the cosmological, associated with the cosmological horizon, when I move the particle by an infinitesimal amount. this quantity is actually a velocity. It's a velocity that you would indeed associate with this particle if you would interpret the redshift as a Doppler shift. There's another reason why I like the velocity is that it has, okay, actually this is then sort of a proposal which I don't know exactly whether it's true. Is indeed use the velocity here.
This is the velocity of
so, okay, I skipped the part now here. What I want to do is put indeed now the stretch horizons on away from the horizon. And what I will choose is equipotential surfaces. I can apply the same reasonings there, but then there is a dimensionless quantity that I can introduce, which is the Newton potential on that equipotential surface divided by c squared. That's dimensionless. So whatever functions I can ask whether my equations which I knew at the horizon, whether they are modified by any function of that dimensionless quantity. On the horizon that number would be 1, or you can make it 0, anyhow it would be 1, but so there is some way in which that function plays a role. So if I write phi in terms of some v squared, that v squared would be, can be interpreted as being the escape velocity that's required to get the particle out to infinity. Anyhow, that thing is what I put here. And I think I'm going to move over this because this is probably the part that I need to explain, learn to explain better. I want to get to the next part. Maybe I should allow indeed some questions about, I mean, you still were not happy with this one because...
there's a limit on how big the horizon, the cosmological horizon can be for a given cosmological constant.
Yes. Oh, you mean this Narai, what is it? Narai?
Yeah, I mean, okay, if you put too much mass in, the black hole horizon and the cosmological horizon become degenerate.
Yes.
Would become a,
but anyhow, this particle, of course, I mean, would not sort of create a black hole yet, but it's true that it probably will affect the position of the horizon. And I would expect that the entropy increases when you allow it to go over here, which is true because it is slightly smaller, as you say, when there's a mass in there. And when it crosses it, it will become slightly bigger. That increase in entropy is the thing that I'm calculating here. Well, it's not the increase when I drop it in. This is the difference in the increase when I drop it from two positions. And it's related to the work that you do when you do it. And this is simply coming from consistency of the equations. So let me now come to a completely different story, although I think it's eventually related. Because of course, eventually you like to have a microscopic picture where these things can come from. And I think indeed, I already mentioned the Born-Oppenheimer picture, so I think eventually you would want to start from a quantum mechanical sort of microscopic situation. You can think about it as the matrix model, but I have reason to believe why we should even go one step below that. Namely, I want to think about the matrix coordinates as matrix elements of an operator in a certain Hilbert space. And that's the Hilbert space I should be thinking about.
Say it again.
Okay, now I'm just telling you intuition.
That's right.
Yeah, maybe I want to do something on the blackboard for the drawing here. Of course, it would be nice to have a microscopic model that eventually one would get these equations from. And, well, we discussed the matrix model as a way of where we understand where gravity sits. They come sort of from integrating out open strings. I think it's fair to say that even, if you think about what we all know from string theory, that many string theorists feel that we don't know really what it is. we know certain elements of it, but we'd really like to know what it is. But so we can also...
To some extent, you know, so far you've talked about ideas trying to relate the emergence of gravity to entropic or integrating how fast they're able.
That's correct.
For example, something you'd like to argue is similar to likeness. More in a general circumstance it would explain gravity emerges, but you haven't really discussed the emergence of space.
Let me do that then now. Because what I think eventually is happening is that there is a quantum mechanical starting point where space is not defined yet, and where even there is a risk that you don't have it, but you want to define it in some approximate sense. And then by integrating or forgetting certain fast variables, there is some reaction force, a la Born-Oppenheimer, which we're going to geometrize in describing it in terms of general relativity and other forces, namely
like the matrix model.
But if that happens, I mean, the matrix model even gives us a supersymmetric theory. If I can understand what gravity comes from, I should also understand what everything is in the supermultiplet from the graviton should come from. We cannot just have emergent gravity and not have emergent other forces. And of course, for the matrix situation, we know that the forces play a role. That when you take two D brains, there's no force between them because they are attracted and repelled. And if I understand one as emergent, it's better to also think about the other one as emergent. So what do we think? What does emergence of space mean? And now let me just take a thing that I extract from the lessons that we learned in string theory. So what makes space emerge? I think it has something to do with statistics.
In the law of large numbers.
No.
Fermions
and bosons. And I think your papers, by the way, are quite inspirational in that sense. We know that we have exchange of particles. If we think about particles as being particles, if space is no longer there, we don't even know what particles are. You cannot give them positions. But we see in statistics that we have that we can make things symmetric or antisymmetric. But this is based on the assumption that the only operation that you can do is exchange the particles. If there's not really, if we start losing the particle concept, maybe we can make it slightly more general. We can rotate one particle into the other one. So instead of having, if I have two particles, I have Z2 as the symmetry group, but I also have the phase rotations. Of course, this is going to be embedded in U2. Because this allows me to make more general modifications of particles. And of course, it also means that I don't have positions anymore of two particles. But I can also have a position operator which has a matrix element between the states of the two particles. So that's not what the matrix does. So the off-diagonal components tell us that there's stuff going on which has nothing to do with the particles anymore. We're making the particles more identical than they were by having even a unitary group acting on them. And we know this in string theory, that if we put all things on top of each other, the symmetries become much bigger. This is the transition from a Coulomb branch to a Higgs branch. And this is where the space is going to be that's pulling things into a black hole. A black hole lives on the Higgs branch. The particles outside are on the Coulomb branch. And the Coulomb branch opens up towards the Higgs branch. And that's what makes the force going. But it's because there are more possibilities when particles are on top of each other. The statistics is not just fermions and bosons. You can allow them to do all kinds of things. So I want to understand where this comes from. If there's a matrix, it means that these are matrix elements between states in a Hilbert space. And there are many things we've seen in string theory that sort of make this happen.
Do you imagine we can do this in four space-time dimensions, or are we going to really be doing string theory?
I think four space dimensions has already a lot of it. Yes, I will show that actually. Yes, because I mean the basic example that you know about is actually three dimensions, and then there's an example in four dimensions. Because the, as you see here, by the way, these are eigenvalues, and we already talked about crossing eigenvalues. Something special happens when eigenvalues cross. And that you can already study in three dimensions. It turns out that if you generically have, I'm getting ahead of myself. But anyhow, this is a slightly different story. Okay, anyhow, this is positions, and indeed, you will see. I mean, yeah, I'll say a little bit more about that. I think that was actually all I wanted to say on the blackboard.
What?
This was all I wanted to say on the blackboard. So I'm going ahead again.
Hey, we're going to talk about.
Well, no, so maybe I will go. You had a question for me, I think. Oh yeah,
about. Got you too.
Oh yeah, let me say this way. Matrix theory uses matrices. And then I always ask, what is the space that the matrices are acting on?
What do you mean, what's the space?
If we have matrices, yeah, they act on a space. Sorry?
The Hilbert space.
There's a Hilbert space, but what is it for matrix theory? What is the role of that Hilbert space? We write down matrix coordinates, but we don't talk about the Hilbert space on which the matrix coordinates are acting. But didn't Heisenberg start from matrices? Eventually he thought it was pretty useful to start about the state space. Of course, also in open string theory, we do something similar by gluing them in a certain way. And we think about them as matrices. By the way, T-duality tells us that X and A sort of are similar things. The gauge fields and coordinates are similar things. But I also think about whatever multiplication in defining open strings. But I think there could be a formulation where these are actually acting on something. And I like a little bit the idea that I think about a sort of Dirac operator, which is constructed out of these quantities and have something which sort of like fermions. And I think string theory may have a formulation that starts from this. And I think we are many.
Sound like Alan Kahn.
That's right. But this is a this is a thing that can contain A. Suppose I integrate this out. And I calculate it.
Well, I mean matrix theory has such things.
Yeah, but I want to make them the things on which they act. So they should be in the fundamental and not in the adjoint. Well, matrix theory has these things in the adjoint.
But you're saying what is missing in matrix theory that is not in your vision? What is not there?
I mean, there's a Hilbert space in matrix theory. It is.
You know, gravity, I would say gravity emerges in matrix theory. So.
I think there's something. I think there's something.
Example of what you want.
It's basically things that I know as well in string theory that tell me that there should be these objects. And one of the, I think I want, okay, string theory has closed strings, it has open strings, but I think there's a formulation that has what I would sort of call, well, in this case it could be half strings, or it could be something more like the D-brains, because the objects that we look at are strings, and they act on something. I want to know what is the fundamental object at the end of the string. And one reason I think this is sort of logical to think about is that, well, first of all, I can replace almost every closed string calculation in terms by open strings, because open strings, when I start integrating them out, their world sheets, they cover sort of the entire moduli space of closed strings. And then closed string field theory looks like Trin-Simons theory. Can't help it.
Open string.
Open string. If I integrate out fermions and I choose an anomaly or whatever, Cubitian sinus theory. I think we should even take the fact that it's transimus theory seriously and saying that there's something inducing the open strings. And I'll tell you, there's even ways I know why this is happening, and it's namely T-duality, as I said, interchanges these two. What I'm going to talk about is that actually these things can be interpreted.
What are the problems with that idea? There are lots of open strings here. The framework would have to be one where it wasn't just fixed.
Anyhow, I don't know what it is. I mean, what I think I want to do is, of course, I can keep working in string theory and try to see how it works, but I can also try to think about a formulation where I see elements of string theory appearing.
But with a particular psi and a particular representation?
I don't want to. I want to first identify a general class where I'll see things like this appearing, and this is what I will do. Based on the same ideas that I had now about gravity, I will show you that by thinking about Born-Oppenheimer and about the corrections to it, I can get elements from string theory in quite a natural way.
So you're a Mac. You're going to. You don't know what this underlying fermion is going.
I don't know what it is, because it's true that the matrix, for calculations, it seems that the matrix theory seems to do quite a bit, but I don't know what it is. Yeah, I'll tell you what one of the reasons I know, but I mean, okay, let me give an example. D2, D0. So I think about a situation with a D2 brain and a D0 brain. The D0 brains can be thought about as fluxes on the D2 brain. Then I can think about the degrees of freedom on the D2 brain or on the D1-0 brain. But there are also strings that connect the two. The matrix description is that of a U1 theory with n units of flux as a quantum Hall system. There is actually a duality that makes me, I can replace the D2 by the D0 and D0 by D2 by doing two T-dualities. What will happen is that you will get a dual description where there's a UN theory with one unit of flux. But in order to describe it, what you actually do is you can construct the dual theory by going to the lambda levels of the system you started from and studying what they do as a function of the other variables, actually the Laughlin gauge argument it is, which gives you the dual descriptions of a UN theory with one unit of flux. And that the gauge field on the other, I mean, so the fermions on that system are the strings that go between the D0 and the D2. And I think about them as sort of these kind of objects. And so we've seen actually that open strings, well, anyhow, this is part of the intuition. And I'll tell you why I'm mentioning it, because now I want to just go to a very general story again. I think I want to indeed go to the slides. Yeah, there's buttons here, okay. And this goes. So I want to indeed go for, start from the Born-Oppenheimer setup. So I haven't really specified what the Hilbert space is. It's just this very general sort of freshman quantum mechanics. Talking about the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. So what this quantum system is, now we discussed some things, but let me first do this just in generality. So what the Born-Oppenheimer says is that if I solve a Schrodinger equation where I assume that there's some parameter x, which is of course not the thing that the wave function depends on, this is just a state, so there's no, the wave functions depend on fast variables. it's just a parameter x which very slowly. So the t dependence here is very slow, and you can make this parametrically slow by introducing here some parameter epsilon that would you can use sort of in some systematic expansion. But in first order, when there's just very slow dependence on x, what you do, you solve the energy eigenstates for the Hamiltonian, and then you basically know that there's a reaction force which is just following from adiabatic solution, namely that you follow indeed the eigenvalue and you simply differentiate it, but you keep n constant. Well, n we know we can write in this form, just through Bohr quantization rule, and I can write the force therefore sort of in this way. And so J is the adiabatic invariant, and this quantity can be thought of as the temperature. It's of course not the temperature, but this is something like the gradient of some adiabatic invariant. Any function of J, by the way, would do. So just this equation, writing something like this, just means that I differentiate the energy while keeping something constant. Then there's just some way in which you can always write it in this form. But now you can ask, what are corrections to this adiabatic theorem? Because if I now make the time dependence slightly faster, there will be a correction. And the first correction is the Berry phase. Namely, if you move the parameter x slowly, then following what the eigenvalue does, when you come back to the same point, it need not come back to the same value. That's the idea of the Berry phase. So the adiabatic solution is basically, you can write it, well, the time dependence even, in the usual form, namely if I take, for instance, the ground state, so here I'm looking at the ground state, then the time dependence is given by this, but there's an additional phase that you pick up due to the fact that x also changes as a function of time. And you can write this in terms of a connection, a U1 gauge field, by integrating this quantity. I've written it down in somewhat abstract notation, but this quantity is basically just differentiating psi 0 as a function of x. So x is again not the argument, x is just keeping track of the set of solutions for a given variable x. So x is a slow variable, and I differentiate x, so it's on parameter space that I do this differential. But there's a U1 sort of connection coming out of it. If you now study the adiabatic forces that you get from this, this will just generate a magnetic force on any object that's moving in it, sort of like an Ahanov-Bohm situation. You can compute the curvature of the Berry phase. It's some quantity. It's defined like this, but in order to calculate it, you can just use standard first order perturbation theory, and then it has this form. The reason I mentioned this is that indeed now you can study what happens when two eigenvalues start crossing. Something very nice happens to the Berry phase. It's a Dirac monopole. And the reasoning is like this. If two eigenvalues cross, the generic form in which you can write the Hamiltonian is by writing it as a Hermitian matrix. The identity you can leave out, and if you put these things on the diagonal and the x and y is off the diagonal, then this is a generic Hermitian matrix without the identity in it. If you then compute this quantity, it will look like a B field of a monopole in a three-dimensional space. This, by the way, is also can be generalized. As I told you, the way that we construct t-duality in the d0, d2 case, we use actually precisely such a Berry phase calculation. There's, if you do take d0, d4, it's even related to how you, so let me do that. d0, d4, there you have, okay, maybe I'm jumping a little fast. So there are ways in which you use a slow variable to construct gauge fields using this Berry phase. You can even do it non-abelian, and this is sort of what I had to show first. Namely, if I look at multiple coinciding eigenvalues, what happens on the locations, you can get Berry phases again. And again, you get, of course, the charge is the number of crossings. So I have things that look like monopoles whose charge gives me the number of crossing eigenvalues. And on the locus of those objects, I have non-abelian gauge fields equal to the charge of the Berry phase. And indeed, it has been shown, actually, it's also a calculation by, I think, Douglas and Berkus, who showed that if you take a probe membrane in the background of a five-brain, that you can understand the C field as a Berry phase of degrees of freedom on the membrane. So these kind of additional forces that we have in closed string theory can also be seen as reaction forces in this kind of picture. So maybe this is a general starting point in which elements of string theory can emerge from calculating the reaction forces on a quantum mechanical formulation. Anyhow, it's quite suggestive that these kind of things behave like monopoles and that they also have these non-abelian gauge fields on them. You may even need to think about a Hamiltonian then that you can construct from it. And it's sort of suggestive that these kind of Hamiltonians, if you compute the eigenvalues, they look precisely like the eigenvalues that we normally know about here, because this object, I should have said it here, this is what is the relation even for you with string theory. This Hamiltonian, its eigenvalue is the length of x, is of course a separation between the two eigenvalues. And it's related to basically the string that's stretching between two brains, because it's precisely this component. So if I put this to zero, that would be the length of the string comes out of an Hamiltonian of that sort. And indeed, string theory sort of shows these kind of Hamiltonians appearing many times. Because the T-duality, I mean, monopoles, instantons, the ADHM construction, the NAM equations are all constructed in similar ways, where you construct the gauge field as a Berry phase. By looking at zero modes of a Dirac operator, you look how they behave as a function of x, you construct the dual, the Berry phase, and they give you the connections. Anyhow, I think it's intriguing that it sort of fits in the same picture if you start from a sort of more born Oppenheimer point of view. So these emergent forces may include even other forces than just the gravitational ones. I think I want to stop there. Yes. Yes.
So in this last part of the talk, you had the Hamiltonian depending on some parameter x.
Yes.
So are we to think of x as space, or is it just an auxiliary variable which is space to start with? Because later on you were talking about space as being part of this matrix, and then the angle is going to be the real space.
The way that I wrote down this last Hamiltonian, it appears that indeed a very natural way in which the Hamiltonian depends on space is precisely in this form where you simply dot x with a gamma matrix. Of course, it's related to this thing here. This would have a slash in it. If I do a t-duality, it has x slash in it. If you look at the spectrum of this object, the natural way of this, and you look at the spectrum of these kind of operators, they look like that. But this is related to the spectrum of this operator. So I can get gravity out of a theory of that sort. And maybe it's just the determinant of such an object where I think about these fermions integrating out. I don't know. I mean, this is, I think, part of the picture.
You still didn't totally answer Mark's question.
What's missing from matrix theory?
Yeah.
It's assuming matrices.
Sorry?
It's assuming matrices.
What do you mean assuming matrices? It's assuming there are
matrices. I know. Of course, there are a way of representing them, but I would like to know what they are. I mean, I like this way of getting to the matrices more, where I say that I have objects in space, which we normally call our building blocks of matter.
That's what we do in space.
I'm telling you how we lose space instead of how we emerge, going the other direction.
So you don't like the X's because they are X's?
No, because...
I mean, as matrices, there's not space here, hasn't yet emerged.
Yes, but I... Maybe it's also, yeah, so it's serious. No, it's these hints that I get from string theory where there is this underlying, I mean, we see it every time happening. In matrix models, there are these free fermions. We see it in topological string theories. We see fermionic formulations. And by the way, as I mentioned the ADHM construction, of course, there's also the twister construction. So I'm always thinking about Joe's remark about the Fermi liquidon twister space. It starts looking more and more like it.
More and more. In your paper, it sounds like you're arguing that any complex enough system on the screen or any, could give rise to some kind of entropic property.
I think entropic forces is a more general thing than, so your question is the one, what are the systems that could give rise?
Well, I mean, there have been some studies of what kind of boundary field theory, control theories, for example, could give rise to something which we might call gravity. From this point of view, it's not. From anything.
No, because
you get some force from anything.
That's true, but I think so the reaction force is quite general, entropic force is quite general, but when does it look like gravity? A very good question. And of course, I mean, the things that Joe sort of noted, I mean, and well, other people as well probably, is that the fact that you have low-lying states and things then very high up, the low-lying state are of course what I would like to think about as my slow variables, and the high things are the things that I want to integrate out. And I think if you want to keep them in the story, you probably don't have even emergence of space. It's only when you integrate them out that you get emergence of space together with gravity. There's no way in which you can emergence of space without gravity, which is the point that I'm making. So there must be additional degrees of freedom that are not included in the low-lying states. Which are the slow variables, and it's the fast variables that induce the gravitational force. But anyhow, I admit I don't have I don't have a theorem that tells you from this starting point I can derive the gravity equations. But I have a feeling that there is a derivation where you can follow some of this logic and probably supplement it with additional input, because what otherwise, I mean, I don't really know how to get from this start, even the Born-Oppenheimer starting point, directly to emerged gravity. But I think I have some dots in the picture, which eventually I would like to connect by a line.
Well, your paper, the radial direction was in some sense put almost on the same footing as the other ones. And
you have a feeling for how that actually works in specific models?
You mean why, on the same footing as the other ones?
It's treated as gravity. Light propagates at the same speed on the radial directionals, on the other directionals.
Okay.
In some sense, from the point of view of harmonization group, it plays a very special role in conformational field theory. But in gravity, it seems that it loses all, doesn't matter.
Yeah. So I think it's nicer if you can think about emergence of space in a more sort of isotropic fashion. But I also think about how we add the additional dimension as a way of representing the causal structure of what happens on the boundary, where you take into account that there's also separation of scales, so that anything that happens at a certain scale does not immediately affect something that happens on a different scale. So the fact that certain signals travel even in scale space is just the reason why we add that dimension. And so the geometry that we construct must be a representation of the dynamics that takes place in the microscopic system. So just by doing that, well, if there's a causal structure, you can give it a light cone, and then by just fixing the light speed in all directions to be the same, which by the way is just a choice, you find that it's sort of isotropic. Because anyhow, I can make corner transformations which make the light cone look very asymmetric.
Well, the fact that you can sort of rotate all the directions, the ones that were space with one that was radial direction, I mean, that's something that you're in some sense allowed to do in gravity, not necessarily.
So we don't understand completely the local Lorentz invariance, that's what you're saying. That's a good question. But even in ADS, I mean, ADS CFT, which we have been studying for 15 years, I mean, do we really know this?
No.
I don't. Do we know why the bulk is really gravity there? I mean, in the usual sense, with all of the symmetries.
Presumably, you would derive it starting from this approach.
That's what.
Many of the steps seem to be.
I said only a few dots, so the line really has to be make. All right. Okay. I thought I would be grilled much harder, actually. Well, maybe then private discussions would do.